conscious as time passed during the 50s and 60s of the number of jobbing firms becoming fewer and fewer?
Yes, it came apparent because some of the jobbers, when the senior partners either retired or died, the money to keep the business turning over wasn't there. So the younger ones either had to not leave, but to go into other firms to keep their business going, their contacts going.
Why do you think that didn't happen in the case of Smith?
Well, I think there was more help coming from the senior partners of the Smith firm than there was in the other firms. The money the other firms had, they didn't seem to want to push it out and didn't want to develop into a larger status. So Smith kept on pushing, getting extra staff in to make the business more expensive.
What had happened to the more senior partners in Smith's? Say that the Smith brothers, had they retired at some stage?
When they retired?
When did...
They retired. Morris Morton Smith went back to South Africa because his family were there and retired. And Charlie Smith got to the age of when he was about 65 or 70, coming up 70. He wasn't with it any longer and didn't want to know. And it didn't cost us anything for us to buy him out. He was just a good man in that way, that the continuity of the business carried on when he left.
And what kind of attitude did you as partners take to running the firm? You said that some partners would retire and take their capital out and the firm would fold or merge, but Smith's had a different
They had a different attitude. They didn't want to be bought out. They just were happy to let the firm continue. I mean, one went to South Africa. We didn't have to pay him anything, although eventually we did do some contributions to him when things got harder for him. But the other Smith, no, just let the firm, happy to know the firm was carrying on and continued to go and making money.
And did you as senior partners now have particular policies for running the firm? Did you want to expand the firm?
Oh yes, yes, yes. We were all for bringing what we call reasonable, good people who would be contributors to the Smith's way of thinking. The juniors, and they went through their process of being a blue button to an authorised clerk to being a partner. They all came through the ranks, if you might say.
How did the firm, or do you have any recollection of particular events in the history of the city or the stock exchange affecting Smith's business? For example, the first 7% bank rate in 1957, or the devaluation in 67, or... You know, the crash of Rolls-Royce or the bear markets.
Well, all these things came through the channels and they had to be adapted to. I mean, some you didn't agree upon, but it was a way of thinking in those days. I mean, as the years progressed, so the time seems to go quicker and some events which you wouldn't thought would happen did happen. It's a process of elimination, shall we say.
And how would you characterise your relations with the brokers with whom you dealt with? Were they fairly friendly, or did you regard them as in some ways your opposition and you had to be fairly sharp with them?
Well, there was what we called the good brokers and the bad brokers. You knew the good ones, you knew the bad ones, and very often the bad ones you never dealt with because they didn't come near you and you didn't ask them for their business. So it was a process of elimination of the ones you knew you had a steady business with and the others who didn't come to you unless they were really pressed and they couldn't do it elsewhere. Then they used you as the last channel.
What was the difference between a good broker and a bad broker?
Well, a good broker would come to you and you make him a reasonable price and he'd do on it. The other broker would come to you and he'd start to fiddle around. Can you give me a bit more? Can you sell him to me a bit cheaper? You knew what he was going to say directly opened his mouth, that he wasn't happy with it. We made a two-way price, which was fundamentally a good price, an aggressive price. And it wasn't take it or leave it. Sometimes a broker was limited and his client would say, I want to buy them at so-and-so, and it was a middle price. And sometimes out of goodwill, you'd put the price, put him down and say, all right, you owe me a turn next time. Just like that.
Well, put-through is beginning to be a part of
business. If a broker had a buying order and a selling order, he had to put it through the market. So you come to you and you agree upon a price inside the buying and selling price. Like it could either be the middle price the seller would get, and the buyer would give it a little bit more for it. That was often done, that was. But he had to put it through the market.
How did you feel about put-throughs? Did you feel it was in some ways unfair to the jobber because
no,
it was taking business
no.
out of your
It was
hands.
Taking business out of the jobber's thing, but a broker, if it was a good broker and you knew he wasn't on the fiddle or anything like that, you did it for him. Mm. It was often done. No, when I say often done, it was a once-a-day effort, you know. It wasn't overdone.
Did you try and expand your market share as against the other firms dealing in equities like Durlacher or
Equites? No. Very rarely did we expand in any other shares than what we were already dealing in. The only time it happened, if a new issue came out, a new flotation of shares, which the broker would say to us, are you prepared to deal in these shares? And we could say yes or no. Mm-hmm. And if we thought it was worth dealing in, we'd say yes, okay, mm-hmm. we'll take them.
So are you referring to underwriting?
Yes,
there?
Yeah.
And what was your attitude to underwriting? Did you regard it as being a service, or was it?
Oh, it's a service, because anybody who underwrites a stock, I mean, is taking on a liability. Mm. So yes, I agree on that underwriting. Yes, mm. If they want to take the liability, I mean, it couldn't be the shares needn't be taken all up, and they could be left with the underwriting and the shares, and that's their gamble. Mm. So it's fair, mm. fair enough.
Did you find as time passed, particularly coming up to the change from the old house to the new house, that the stock exchange as an institution was changing to the stock exchange that you'd known as a younger man during the 1930s, either purely in terms of dress standards and the way people behaved?
Well, we were, let's say, the elder partners were probably old-fashioned, but again, we had to recognise it was progress. Mm. And progress, all right, you don't agree on everything it does. I mean, for instance, the white stiff collar I wore for 20 or 30 years went out. I don't say jeans came back in the market, but it's got down to a pretty low level. By the time it finished, it was on a much lower standard than we were used to when we were younger.
Archie was ashamed.
I was ashamed a bit because it lowered the prestige of the stock exchange. We always regarded ourselves as gentlemen of the city. Mm. Stiff collars and what have you. Even in the end, I was wearing a soft collar, so you can tell us. It did depreciate a bit, yes. Mm. But, as I say, progress, as this time goes on, you have to adopt it.
Mm. Mm. Sad. Now, one other thing I wanted to ask you about was that one thing occasionally people I've interviewed have referred to is people trading on PA, personal account. Was that a sort of unwritten occurrence? Or
it was unwritten occurrence, yes. In my firm, everybody had to sign a form saying they would not deal for their personal account, PA, unless they referred it to the senior partner or a partner, so there wouldn't be any jickery-pokey.
What was your impression about that in the stock exchange generally? Was it different to, say, your younger days? Would have people been a lot more free and easy? Or I mean, was it a common occurrence, or was it uncommon?
In the older days, it was a common occurrence for people to deal with PA, and that's where you had the fraudulent crop up here and there. And it often became a committee, stock exchange committee, council ruling. And there wasn't a laid down ruling to the fact that you couldn't deal with PA, but it was held in very low regard that unless the firms were notified, there could be trouble. Mm. And I think it was adhered to in the end that most firms had a thing that the senior partner should know what was going on. Mm.
If someone wanted to trade on PA, how would they go about doing it?
Well, they wouldn't do it through their own firm. Mm.
So they'd
They'd put it through a broker. They'd ask a broker saying, I'm going to buy 500 ICI for my own account. Will you do it for me? And some brokers would adopt it and charge the commission and do it. Mm. Oh, yes, it could be done. So it was often done.
So did you have cases of jobbers and brokers becoming too close in the sense that they were more interested in doing their own private business between them rather than...
No, I don't think so. It was only on a small percentage, very small percentage.
And what about what we now think of as, or what we now call as insider trading? Was that an occurrence, or was
that,
it?
That was a small occurrence, not so big as it used to be. I mean, in our days, it was a very small, petty thing which was recognised, and nobody did much about it. Mm. But the inside business now, that is rather horrific, terrible. If they're caught, they're in trouble, as you know. But I don't think many firms do it. I think it got out of hand a bit. But I don't think they do it in a minute much more now because it's they're up before the beaks and the juries, and there's trouble.
When you say it got out of hand a bit, was that within recent times or within?
Oh no, I'm talking about 10 years ago. Mm. It got out of hand. There was papers in the papers and that, and inside people gossip and what have you.
Just changing the focus a little bit, was the shop brokers an important part of one's business in the sense of it was important to stay in touch with the shop broker? Or was it more important for the shop broker to stay in touch with you as the jobber?
Well, as a jobber, really, you couldn't ask the shop what his business was. It wasn't thought of very high regard to ask the shop broker what the firm, his firm were doing with the company they were adopted. Mm. No, you couldn't do that, no.
But did you have much contact with the broker dealing
company? Oh, yes. I mean, supposing you had a buyer from a broker and you couldn't deal in the market, you go to the shop and say, look, I've got a buyer of 50,000 ICI, can you help? And often he'd say yes at a certain price, he would hold it. And if the price suited you, you'd adopt it, yes. That'd be the last straw, but other than going to the market and trying to deal through other brokers, you go to the shop to broker.
Mm. How would you have compared the South African market with the industrial market in that sense? Was were the markets controlled in very different ways, or, well, not controlled, but influenced by different factors?
Well, they're a very different category because if you're dealing with the British industrials, I mean, it was easy. But if you're dealing with the gold mining shares, South African shares, it was very hard. First of all, we couldn't contact them, only by telegrams in those days, or telegraph or anything like that. So really, I mean, it was a bit vague. They were out of your hand. Much difficult to do in the gold mining shares than it was in the industrials market.
Did you find there were almost, in a sense, two firms within Smith Brothers? One that was oriented towards the gold markets?
Yes. You couldn't, I mean, if the gold market was good, you wouldn't say the British market's got to be good. Mm. It could be right the opposite. No, they were a bit too different. And the South African market was much more volatile than the British industrials. First of all, there wasn't the number of shares available. And secondly, they were wider prices than industrial prices. The industrial prices are very, what I call, close. You get a very close spread of buying and selling, where on the other hand, the South African shares were much wider. You could make more money in the gold mine because you had a wide range of prices. Quickly, see, if you were right, if you're on the right tact, bull or bear.
Now, you mentioned that at some point you started to attend the annual general meetings of firms like ICI. Did the firm have similar contacts with the South African companies?
No. They used to have to go out there. Mm. They had no contacts in London. They had their offices in London, but they weren't. They were only subsidiary companies. Mm. And they weren't the main people. If they wanted to know or get closer relations, they had to go out to Joburg and meet them out there.
And what was the benefit to the firm of having contact with the companies?
Well, not a lot of benefit in respect, really. Just to know that what they were doing in their shares and what they thought of their shares, which they probably couldn't tell them on the telephone, and mouth to mouth is much better than a long distance call.
Did you still feel that you tended to know a bit more about the company than the brokers did? Or did you find that as time passed, the brokers began to develop a lot more expertise in the shares?
Over a period, the brokers did get more expertise, but on the face of it, on the frontal part about it, that beforehand, if you dealt in a range of companies, you got to know the companies through experience and their moves and their volumes of shares and their placing of shares and their bringing on new issues. So you got to know the companies much better like that.
And was that still something that the brokers looked?
The brokers always came to the jobbers, really, and they reckoned that the jobbers knew as much as they could and could help them. Because we used to keep statistics and ups and downs, the lower and prices for the year and the higher price. We used to keep it on our books so that we had a good reckoning of what was going to happen. Some shares, I mean, hardly moved during the whole year. Other shares were top and bottom, you know. Really move smartly, especially some of these speculative stocks that came out.
Can you remember any of those?
Well, I told you one, GRA, went from a shilling to 25 bob in 1 year, which was fantastic. I mean, before the war, they were a shilling to one and six, and that was the whole year. They went from a shilling to 25 bob in a year, and Q's buying them thousands and thousands. And amazing, it was just a one-off.
Did you notice much difference in broking firms between the Casanovas and the Hoare & Co's and the Panmure Gordons and the smaller broking firms? Were they a different animal?
Very big difference. Very big difference. The major 10 companies, I would say, major 10, you mentioned six then, but the major 10 companies, they're far and higher. Their quality, it was a quality like you might say Harris to Marks & Spencer's in a small kind of way. The quality of the business was good. They had the cream of the business. They had the bigger orders. I mean, if Casanova came to you, rent was 25 to 50,000. The other small man came to you, was between 1 to 5,000.
Did you make different prices to different brokers?
No. You only made, no. The only price you made differently was on the amount of the shares. You made the same price to whether it was Casanova or AJ Becker or someone like that. You made them the same price on the share, unless it was 10 to 50,000. I mean, when the broker came to you, he always said to you, what's the price in ICI? And you used to say 39 and 4 and 87 and 80, something like that. And he'd say, what sort of market are you making it in? And you say the regular price, 5,000, 10,000 if it's your lot. If he said, oh no, I'm bigger than that, you say, well, what sort of number? If he says 50,000, you make him a price. If you didn't deal on the price, then he'd say, well, I'll buy 5 or 10,000 from you and go on and chance my arm with the other jobbers. But he'd have to tell the other jobbers you'd been elsewhere.
What would you do if a broker came and told you that he'd been elsewhere?
Well, I'd treat him as the same as the other jobber dealt elsewhere. If it suited me, I'd say, all right, well, I'll sell you 5,000. If it suited me, I'd probably finish his order, depending on the accumulation of the stock I've got on my book or I haven't got on my book. Or the chance I wanted to take. But the broker has to be fair and say, I've been elsewhere, I've dealt in 5,000. What are you prepared to do with me? And you could say the lot, or you could say, I'm sorry, bugger off. Or go.
I beg your pardon.
Go. Well, that's the expression, you know. That's the expression, you know, on your way, bruh, fella, you know. But I mean, you had a liberty, or could say what you want to once he opened up and told you. But as he was so fair, you often helped him on his way, either by finishing him off or helping him on the way with a certain amount.
Were you able to have some idea what the other jobbers were making to the brokers?
No.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Do you have any idea what your competition was
you
doing?
You generally knew you were in the range. You guessed that by the way people dealt with you. Because most brokers, although they favoured dealing with you, they would sometimes check their price elsewhere. Or most often, for the client's sake, They would check the price elsewhere, and if they came to you and they were making the same price and they liked you, they'd deal with you. There was a slight preference for some brokers to deal with certain jobbers, but only if it suited their client.
Did you find, some people have referred to the different techniques of jobbing, like, for example, lip reading, or the way you'd manipulate the prices on your board to try and fox the other that jobbers. Did that play much part in your jobbing?
No, that was too apparent. It was too apparent. I mean, once anybody saw you lip reading or just putting your price on your board and they looked at your board and you weren't making that price, they soon knew that you weren't playing the game. And the old adage of my word is my bond, you know, and all that business, you had to stick to it. No, there's certain principles you had to stick to, you know. It didn't behove you to try and cheat the broker. Because once you start cheating the broker, you wouldn't see him anymore. You'd lose your business.
Just again, to change the subject a little bit, did the introduction of the capital gains tax seem to make much difference to business in the stock exchange? That's, you know, the early mid-60s.
Yeah.
Did people tend to turn over there?
Yes, if they reached the limitation if they reached the limitation of the capital gains tax and it wasn't going on, you find that they didn't bother anymore. If they made a couple of good profits and it reached the 5,000 mark or the price that the capital gains tax was at the time, didn't bother, didn't go on, no point. Only giving the way back to the tax man.
Did you notice any effect on liquidity?
Slightly, not a lot. It wasn't a major factor.
Were there fewer jobbers trading in the stocks in which you were jobbing?
Yes, I suppose the top 10 jobbers, they didn't deal in all the stocks they all each other had, but I would say 50 or 60% of the stocks they all joined in and dealt in, yes. I mean, where there's a big issue, a big capitalised stock, and there was plenty of shares to deal in, yes, you had a wider range of jobbers. Because they could make money on a bigger market. But the small companies, no, there was only probably two or three jobbers dealing in the smaller companies.
Did you ever find that liquidity in a stock completely dried up?
Not very often.
Well, switching the focus to you again, you've described your career more or less up to the point that you became a partner. Mm. How did your career unfold until you retired? Did you rise up in seniority? Did you acquire any particular responsibilities in the firm? Did you have an influence in the way the firm
developed? Well, we had a partners meeting once a week when we all put our little problems. We all put our little problems together and tried to smooth them out and find out what was happening. We generally had the manager in once a week, find out what his problems were in the office staff, whether he wanted more staff, whether he was carrying on right, whether he had anything to blunt his temper on. When we reached the four of us senior directors, that was Davis, Marks, myself, and Ranson. We were the four seniors. Nobody had more stake than others. There were four equal partners, or directors we came afterwards. We were four equal partners, and we had a very good mutual agreement. And if the majority wanted this and that, we went along with it.
Now, when did you decide to become a company as opposed to a private partnership?
1972, I think, wasn't it? I said 1972.
What was the background to that?
The background was that we wanted the shares because it was the capitalisation of our money. We had the money in the firm earning interest, but nothing to what our shares would be. By getting the shares in our names and the partners below us, they had their share as well. So it meant, not like golden handshakes, but it was really, it was way of means of getting money into your hands by having the shares. Right, we had a mutual agreement we wouldn't plonk the shares out and sell them until we retired, which we didn't. And we stuck to it. I didn't sell shares until I retired.
And when did you start thinking about retiring?
Well, I was 58, and I was thinking then, I thought, I wasn't being over-pressurised. I mean, quite frankly, I was in good health and what have you, but I thought to myself, what am I going on for? I've got enough money now. I mean, now. Then, the money I had then is nothing now compared with the way the money has accelerated. The money I had then and have got now is nothing to what probably the Lettermans have got. They've probably got much more than I have now because they stuck it out for, you know, and their shares have appreciated. I mean, if you look at the balance sheet, you'll see Jeff Letterman's got about 150,000 shares. Gerald has, and Jeff's got about 70,000. And I think Tony Lewis got about 54,000 left. You only look at the balance sheet and you see that on there. So that's a way of earning money quicker than getting the interest and paying tax on. Because you don't have to sell the shares in one lump, otherwise you pay capital gains tax. But if you sell them in small parcels, you're free of capital gains tax. But as you asked me, I got 58 and 59, I said to the other three, I'm packing in at 60. And they laughed at me and thought I was, you know, stupid. I said, I'm going to live down at Bournemouth. I'm going to enjoy the rest of my life, hopefully live another 5 years longer than I would have done. Mm. Pressure's off me. Mm. I'm happy. I've no grudge against any of you. And within 3 years, the other three got out, one by one.
How did you find leaving the stock exchange?
Very sad.
Did you miss it?
I had several big parties. I mean, I gave a party to all the brokers, and we had a party. They gave me a party, as you see by that in the Dorchester. But the comradeship I miss badly. Not going up every morning and speaking to everybody and saying, how are you, what's new. It's the friendliness of your friends you've made over the last, say, 30 or 40 years. No longer you're there than wanting to say hello, goodbye, and that was the hardest part of it. I reckon it took me 5 years to get over there. That'd be my son. You answered every afternoon. Tell me how the market is.
Well, I'll ask you a few concluding questions now.
Yes.
What did you think it took to be a successful jobber?
First of all, not to let things get the better of you. Secondly, to keep your head. And thirdly, to be nice to everybody without being spiteful. If you want to create a good business, you've got to be amicable. And all right, sometimes it didn't suit you to help anybody, but given the good spirit of the person you're dealing with, you'd help them and you'd do your best to help them. Sometimes it didn't suit you, but you knew they'd come back and in some way they'd recompense you in the way that you'd recompense them. Mm. I think the thing was to keep friendly and be nice to everybody and build up a good comradeship.
Can you think of any cases where you had to keep your head in jobbing?
It's a difficult question to answer that one. There was often cases where you took on an order and it started to go well and then suddenly it either collapsed on you, what have you, and you either had to make up your mind quickly, whether you were going to stick with what you thought was right or cut it. Now, it's all the hardest thing in the world is to cut a bargain if you think it's right. But sometimes it paid to cut it because they used to say in the stock exchanges, the first cut is the cheapest. So you went along and cut it and start again.
What do you think were the qualities of an unsuccessful jobber? Did you know of unsuccessful jobbers in your career?
Well, as I said to you before, a jobber could only maintain and keep his business if he kept a good relationship with the brokers. And if you wanted a broker come and deal, supposing a broker come and dealt with me and or any other jobber, and the broker did the order, and the poor old jobber lost a lot of money on it, and the jobber, who shouldn't, he called the programme and told him what he thought of him, that job, that programme would never go back to him again. So you had to take it or leave it and keep a straight face and say, all right, next time I may win, you know. But it's no good going, what I call belly aching to the broker and saying, oh, you did me a bad turn there. Because the broker's thinking, all right, I'm coming to you again.
Did you think that the jobbers were a different breed to the brokers? Would you, for example, have ever considered going over to become a broker rather than a jobber?
No. No, I wouldn't. I would never... Well, if I was forced to, you've got to build a good clientele up to become a broker. It's no good having two or three people to deal with because those two or three people may only deal once every month or 2 months. You can't live on that. So I admire a broker because he's got to build a good clientele. Not only build the clientele, but make the clients money, which is also very hard to do. If you get onto a client and say, I think you should buy this and it's wrong, that client won't come back to you anymore. So he's got to be 9 times out of 10 right with his telling the broker, the broker's got to tell the client that he's going to be right and he's going to make money out of it. So no, I think